Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Five Rings to Rule Them All. I'm Sid Ziegler. Gosh, it was 10 years ago, before the 2010 Winter Olympics, that Kalyn Chithluk-Sifsoff first messaged me and said, you know, I think I want to come out before the Olympic Games. She's from Alaska. The Games were being held in Vancouver, right down the street, so to speak, from where she grew up. Family was going to be there, and she wanted to do it totally publicly out. She ended up deciding not to do that. But 4 years later, in Sochi, with all the conversations about LGBTQ athletes and LGBTQ rights, queer visibility in Russia, Kalyn decided to come out then. Finally caught up with her for my podcast. We talk about all of that. We talk about what she's up to today, her coaching, working on a boat in San Francisco Bay, and also the issues surrounding racism. She is Indigenous Alaskan, is literally the first Indigenous Alaskan to ever represent the United States in the Olympic Games. So it was wonderful to finally catch up with Kalyn 10 years later. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Kalyn, thank you for taking time away from, well, that's not time away from your sailboat. You're on your sailboat right now. What are you looking at from your sailboat right now as we talk?
Oh, man, I'm looking at the halyards blowing against the masts of the bay, the San Francisco Bay here. And I was just every day living on this boat has been truly like a California dream, just so cliche. But it's been so much fun. Right now I'm looking at the Bay Bridge. I'm looking at beautiful, gorgeous California day right now.
Growing up in Alaska, is this where you saw yourself at this point in your life?
No, I didn't not see myself here. I kind of always have liked sailboats from afar. And I grew up in a place in Alaska where people commercial fish for a living. So when I grew up, we were on boats, every single summer. And so I'm really familiar with the boating world. And I also currently work on commercial boats here in the San Francisco Bay. But so anyway, I've always loved sailboats. I don't know anything about sailing, but hopefully in the next weeks I'll learn how to sail.
How does someone get from, and when we're talking about small town Alaska, where you grew up, we're talking about really small, right?
Yeah, it's a really small town, like 200 people, I think, is the population of Aleknagik. It's a native allotment system. So basically, I grew up with my whole family on one stretch of road, basically. And then, very, very rural community, kind of like no other in the world, honestly. And it was a little bit of a fluke the way that I ended up being a professional snowboarder. But it also is similarly pretty natural, because in that part of Alaska, there is a pretty flat stretch along the coast. And then right where I grew up, there's a little patch of mountains. And And so when I was little, my brother was into snowboarding. And I think he had mail order snowboard videos that he would get from catalogs, and he always had subscriptions to snowboard catalogs. And so because he was so into it, I that was all I knew from an early age was snowboarding with him. So I started when I was 7, and then my family, everyone kind of gets around on snow machine in that area in the wintertime. So we would go kind of collectively as a family to mountains, and my parents would kind of drive us up the mountain, and then we'd hike the remaining portion to the peak, and then they'd pick us up. So in that part of the world, it's a lot different, and kind of recreate, or some people do, you recreate on your everyday basis. So I was really fortunate to grow up in that area. And then because I spent so much time snowboarding, it ended up being, I developed a lot of good fundamentals. And it's kind of weird because most people start on ski resorts, but I started, hiking up and down in what people call the backcountry. So for me, that was like a real nice edge that I didn't really know that I had.
How do you get from there to the literally the top of the world in your sport? You know, other people, they're discovered by a coach, or like you said, they're at a ski resort and they get recognized. How did that happen with you? Just literally driving up and hiking up a mountain and just going down.
Yeah. Well, so it kind of begun with my mom's decision to move me out of the, so in Alaska, you call the rural area the bush, basically, is where we're from. And so my mom decided there's a few different things happening, like education in the state was being underfunded, I think, that year. And so they'd cut sports programs, they'd cut like all extracurriculars and art programs from school. And it's pretty limited as far as public schools and what they offer in that area in the first place. So my mom wanted to get me out of the village and kind of expose me to a little better education and opportunities. And so her and I moved to a ski resort just outside of Anchorage called Girdwood. And the ski resort is called Alyeska Ski Resort. And so she picked that because it was within proximity to Anchorage in the urban area, but it wasn't, the shock value of moving to a big city. So it was a small town. And she knew that I loved snowboarding. So my brother, I think she just kind of thought, well, this would be a good place because it's where I had a hobby. And so right away, it was just amazing to live there. And rather than hiking up mountains every day, like I did in the village, I had a chairlift. So for me, that kind of changed my snowboarding. I didn't necessarily have intentions to be a pro snowboarder in that particular moment when I was like 13, 14. And if anything, the opposite, I think there was like a few competitions going on at the resort when I first got there. And my mom asked if I wanted to compete. And I said, no. And then the following year, a bunch of my friends did. And so I kind of was like, well, sure, I'll try it. But yeah, as far as moving to the ski resort, it was just blew my world to be able to make endless runs all day without hiking.
Yeah, it must be a bit of a culture shock. You mean, wait a second, my mom doesn't have to drive me up the mountain and I don't have to be exhausted by the time I get there from hiking the rest of the way?
Yeah, exactly. And then you can get some food up there in the lodge. But yeah, it was just great. I had a really wonderful experience being in middle school, and the public school there had a ski program, so you could ski every Thursday as a group with your school. And it was just the perfect place to cultivate, where I'd kind of spent my younger years learning the basics of snowboarding. than at the ski resort. I kind of maybe developed a little bit more of a mature and competitive type of snowboarding. And then when I entered one of the local competitions, you have an opportunity pretty easily to qualify for a national competition. And so I qualified for that. And I'm lucky enough to have a mom that, you know, paid for a lift ticket and seasons pass every year. And then, you know, when I had the opportunity to do that, most parents, and I definitely witnessed my fellow friends, their parents said no, that they, you know, it's too much money to go to the nationals, and probably didn't think their kid was going to, you know, go that far. So for me, I was just really lucky. It was something that I loved, and my mom fully backed it. And when I got the national spot, she paid for me to go. And I ended up doing really well pretty immediately when I was like 14, 15. And then when I was 16, I was invited. I think I had just turned 16, but I was invited to be on the national U.S. national snowboard team. So, yeah.
As you're going through this journey in snowboard, I assume that you are also learning more about yourself and your sexual orientation. What was that like as you're progressing through the sport?
Oh man, I've definitely always been that kind of textbook tomboy when I was little. So my sexuality, for me, there's so many identities that I have, and it's hard to cling to any one of them because they all equally equate to who I am. But yeah, so being, it's so interesting for me to think about them because they kind of intersect. And but yeah, as far as my sexuality, I've always known that I was gay, 100%, and I knew that pretty early on. I can't really put my finger on it, but I always wanted to look like my brother, and just full tomboy. And then I think at one point through snowboarding, I was pretty focused on snowboarding and activities, and so through middle school and high school, I just kind of didn't really have, you know, anything that I was aware of other than my sports and activities. And then I don't know when it was exactly, I had a girlfriend when I was 18, and her name was Simona, and she was on the Swiss snowboard team. And so that was my first kind of real realization. I'd always known I was some sort of a tomboy, and absolutely knew that I didn't have crushes on men or boys. And so when I had that first relationship with a woman, it was something I'd already known pretty concretely, but didn't quite assess, if that makes sense.
How was it dating somebody on another country's team that you were competing against?
Oh man, for me it was great because honestly, I beat her all the time. She probably wouldn't like to hear that, but for me, it was really good. I was a little nervous that it would be hard to compete against her, but you know, in the end, it's kind of the fun thing about snowboarding, and I can't say for other sports, but it's sort of a lifestyle sport as much as it is a competitive sport. And so at the end of the day, with your fellow competitors, all of them across the board, you share this mutual kind of love of the day and the weather and the sport and the good times that we all share. So for me, it just was great. It was a really nice thing to have a partner on tour that shared the same kind of lifestyle that I did. So I had no. And it was probably easy because I usually came out ahead in races. So
that definitely helps. You've competed in multiple World Cups, X Games, and you've competed in multiple Olympics. And I'm wondering, the first Olympics, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you competed in was 2010 in Vancouver. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was my first Olympics, exactly, yeah. And I would add actually one thing about you know, just my experience dating the Swiss snowboarder was for me, actually, I think we both helped each other in training often, and I would go to Switzerland during the off season and train with them in Soft Space Switzerland, and was lucky enough to have them invite me on those trips. And then, but yeah, I think actually having a relationship with a fellow competitor was really good for my snowboarding. Anyway.
I guess when it's suddenly in the family, you talk about it more, you share tips more, and yeah, you want to beat the other one, but you also want the other one to succeed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How was it growing up in Alaska and having your first Olympic Games being right there in Vancouver? Was that extra special for you? Were family and friends able to come see you compete?
Yeah, having the Olympics in Vancouver was a blessing, because nearly my entire family was able to come. And then I also had a pretty hefty group of friends that ended up making it down. And it was, for most of the people that arrived, it was a complete surprise for me. So it definitely added to the magic of the experience to have people share that with me. So yeah, makes me tear up, because it's, I think most people don't have the opportunity, and us in North America were super lucky to have the game so close to home. So.
Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
Your second Olympic Games was 2014, and that's what I want to kind of focus a bit on, because as most of our listeners are aware, it was in Sochi about 6 months before the government of Russia said it was cracking down on the expression of homosexuality. And I know that Australian snowboarder Belle Brockhoff came out publicly the summer before. And I'm curious, as you're leading up to the Olympics and you see all this conversation about this topic, how are you feeling going into that Olympic Games?
Yeah, well, I think the decision to come out publicly kind of coincided with my own politics at the time. I've always been a really politically involved person since I was younger. And then I think typically before I came out that year, I'd lent my voice and my platform to kind of to nonprofits and organizations that try to increase opportunity for marginalized groups and people of color. So I typically, in addition to snowboarding, it never quite has been enough to just focus on snowboarding. And for me, there's so many more important things in the world, and sports is extremely important to me, but it's always been a kind of a venue for me to live my regular life. The sports and my engagement with sports is a constant. And so, but I also feel the need to constantly engage, you know, in the real world. And I'm lucky enough to have gotten the opportunity to be a professional athlete. And so, for me, it's always just been important to use a platform if you have it and you're lucky enough to have a voice that people...
Heading into that Olympic Games, was this conversation about these issues, was it a distraction to you? Was it a motivator to you? Or was it just kind of bubbling in the background?
No, it definitely... I've always faced... Like I usually try to keep a stiff upper lip when it comes to talking. Well, traditionally, I think right now our world is opened up enough where there's conversations that we can have now that you definitely, as a young adult, I didn't feel like I could have 10 years ago. And so for me, my sexuality has always been, I've definitely faced a lot of discrimination for it. Absolutely. Not to the highest degree that I've heard of some people experiencing, but I've definitely experienced it. Like living in Salt Lake City, Utah, was really difficult as someone that is obviously not a feminine woman, and in a place where it's really important kind of aesthetically to be feminine and a homemaker in that culture of that state. And so there were a lot of weird things that happened while I was living there. Like, there were firecrackers thrown at one of my girlfriends and I as we were holding hands. Another friend of mine in Salt Lake was working at the local grocery store, and a group of teenagers bought a couple cartons of eggs from him, and then waited for him outside. He's a very kind of feminine presenting man, and waited for him outside. This is just a block away from my house and right where I got thrown firecrackers at. And then the kids waited for him and then threw eggs at him and screamed homophobic slurs. And so these are things that I'm sure everybody, you know, as a lesbian woman or a gay woman or a queer woman, if you, you know, there's so many instances where, not so much anymore, but if you're seen kissing your partner, you know, it becomes a sexualized moment for other people. And so, you know, just as a queer person, I've definitely experienced so many different forms of discrimination, for sure. I've also felt comfortable enough to kind of stand for what I believe. And so I usually downplay, you know, that kind of thing to my friends, but on a platform, I have no problem talking about these things. But yeah, anyway, the catalyst, I guess, long story short, the catalyst for speaking out at Sochi was just the fact of my lived experience, and, you know, experiencing all kinds of different things, from being sexualized as a gay woman by men. And it's just one of those things. It's hard to answer that question, because if there's such a glaringly obvious conflict in my life where my sexuality and then my job, which is a professional athlete, it's hard to just keep quiet about that and not speak to the issue. And for me, just completely, I'm not able to participate if I don't understand the system and what I'm a part of. So anyway, that was a long answer, but.
Do you hear about these kinds of things in and around Salt Lake City today?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Do you described a couple of pretty heinous incidents with you and a friend of yours in and around Salt Lake City. Do you hear about those kinds of things happening today?
I actually don't. There was a period of time, I think, when there was so much going on with the legalization of marriage and Salt Lake being a pretty central place for that fight. I don't know, but I think that might have contributed to the, for me, what felt like a rise in aggression towards homosexual and queer people and trans people in Utah. But obviously, I think that's kind of always there, and people are aware of those kind of things. But I don't, for me, I have not experienced any kind of negativity towards my sexuality in a very long time. I can't even quantify it, because I don't remember the last time I've faced a negative encounter. I think the firecracker incident would probably be the last time.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Here in Los Angeles, and this was 20 years ago, but I had eggs thrown at me on the sidewalk, and I was called slurs by people driving by. I haven't seen that personally in a long, long, long time. But
yeah,
it's not fun when that happens.
No. Well, for me, you know, what's funny about talking about, like, you know, the shifts culturally is, for me, race is kind of a glaringly big issue I've always had to face. And then gender has always been a secondary thing. And I've always kind of enjoyed keeping up with the men and enjoyed, you know, whatever kind of stigmas I had as a child and being athletic and keeping up with my brother. Those were things that were fun for me. And so my one of the bigger issues in my life has been my experience with being a person of color, and especially in the all-white industry and world with skiing and snowboarding. And for me, I just think it's related in this particular, when we're talking about cultural shifts, and for me, it's important to constantly keep discussions relevant. And for race, it's extremely important, especially we can see what's happening now. Like, I can count 10 different people that have a different narrative on race than they did last year, that I know, like white people that have a different way of discussing race, a different language that they're using. And it's really positive for me, and it makes me feel really good as a person of color to have more recognition of these issues. However, you know, it can be one of those things that you have to continue to push and talk about, because people need pressure in order to continue. And, you know, it, for me, it kind of is interesting to think of people shifting so quickly in a year, and then thinking of the opposite happening. All of the progress can easily be undone if we don't continue to push. So for relating that to queer and LGBTQ issues, that's exactly the same, in my opinion, as, you know, for every, even though it might feel safe right now to be queer, you know, it's more important than ever to be vigilant and aware of our rights, to vote, to also have communication with other groups and people working towards civil rights and equality, and continuing to push the envelope. And we can see that it's more important than ever.
You talk about being the rare person of color in a lily white sport. You are also the very first Indigenous Alaskan to represent the United States in the Olympics. It's beyond just your sport. It's representing all of the United States in what is the pinnacle of sports. How has that racism shown up to you?
It's kind of an all, you know, just like I think with most queer LGBTQ people, when you ask, okay, have you ever experienced discrimination because of your sexuality? It's kind of, and then to quantify that is hard because it's kind of nuanced for some people all the time and kind of all around you for a lot of people. But for me, the issue of race is just always and everywhere for me. And we live in a country that it's founded on white supremacy, and it certainly has never, in my awareness in life, I've never seen anything but white supremacy. So for me, as a person of color, that's just constant, always navigation of this world that we live in. So
it's amazing because there are just so few people, and I've been talking to a small handful of athletes of Asian descent, and they see so few out LGBTQ athletes of Asian descent, and we see so few LGBTQ athletes of Indigenous descent, and I can imagine having this sense of almost feeling like you're this unicorn that just with very few role models trying to find a path for yourself.
Yeah, no, you're so right, nailing it. Yeah, no, it has sometimes felt that way. It also, in some regards, has felt super. Like almost my sexuality has always been an outlier in every community that I've been in, whether that's my Indigenous community or sporting community or professional community or urban community or any community. So, and then the funny thing is throughout my travels, I basically traveled from 16 to 24 or 25 pretty consistently. And I remember going to gay bars in Barcelona and just kind of stopping off in the gay districts of different cities. I don't think I recognized it at the time, but now it's really kind of a sweet thing to think of. It was a global community that I felt a part of a little bit. As cheesy as it is, I would see the rainbow flag in the gay districts, quote unquote, in all these cities. And I didn't have to think about race. I didn't have to think about like any kind of challenge. It's just we're all outliers in that community. So.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I love traveling the world to different gay communities because it doesn't matter which gay community I go to, whether it's Boston or Fire Island or Berlin or London, I always find my people.
Yeah, totally.
It's almost like you just you always have a place to stop in and have a drink and say hi to somebody.
Familiar vibes. Yeah, no, it's great.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Just quickly, what are you up to these days?
Well, so currently I've been coaching a team in Utah, so the Park City Snowboard Team, for the last 4 years now. And then I've also been currently, I'm all summarized the answer. So I work in Park City as a snowboard coach in the winter, and then I work in the maritime industry in the San Francisco Bay in the summer. And I'm currently working towards a captain's license, like a 100-ton captain's license, and then I work right now as a deckhand on a couple different vessels in the bay. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. And I always have a few different projects going on. I kind of travel back and forth to Alaska and do a lot kind of engagement with nonprofits and stuff still. So I do a little bit of everything right now.
You're a Renaissance woman.
It's ended up that way. I should pick something. But,
I try to end every podcast with the same couple of questions. So I'll ask you these.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, I don't know why I didn't tell you this. My big 10-year plan right now is to eventually acquire a vessel that I can sail around the world, and not as like any kind of specific like accomplishment or anything, but just to kind of live on a boat and see where that takes me. So that's my plan. Anyway,
I grew up in New England in a family of fishermen, and I think you're crazy.
Well, sailboat life is better than fishing life. I'll tell you that.
Fishing, that's a lot. Fishing is tough.
Yeah.
Okay, the two questions I try to ask everybody. Number one, and if you don't have an answer for this one, it's okay, because some people don't. Are you familiar with The Lord of the Rings?
I am, yes.
Well, the name of the podcast is Five Rings to Rule Them All, which is taken from a line in Lord of the Rings. And I always ask people just to kind of share a character or a moment from Lord of the Rings that you really like.
Ooh, I have a funny little anecdotal history with Lord of the Rings because I went to New Zealand pretty frequently for training. And it's the setting of it's where The Lord of the Rings was filmed. And I had this really, really weird thing where I don't remember which year it was, but one of my roommates, I was moving out of a place I was renting and randomly found this Lord of the Rings replica ring in like a corner of the room under the bed or something from some previous roommate. And I didn't think anything of it. I was just like, huh. And then I maybe put it in my bag or something on accident. And I went to New Zealand the next couple of days, and then we're just laughing and joking about how, you know, this is where the Lord of the Rings was filmed. And I just remembered that I had the I remembered that I had the ring in my pocket or in my backpack. And so I ended up just taking it out and throwing it in the Lake Wanaka there. So it's so cheesy, but that was kind of a silly, funny Lord of the Rings moment.
You had your Gollum moment. I'm proud of you for being able to cross the ring into the lake. Very, very good. Well done.
Well, it's still there. Maybe I always feel like maybe I have to go back.
Second question, name for me an Olympian who has inspired you.
Oh man, I have a couple Olympians that have inspired me, and it's funny because a lot of them later in life as an adult. So there was definitely two Olympians I always looked up to from an early age, and that the one was Rosie Fletcher, who is an Alaskan Olympian that got a bronze medal in Torino. And then the other Olympian is Seth Westcott. And so he is on my team, longtime teammate. And for me, he's always been a hero of mine because he exemplifies, and I got a chance to see firsthand through traveling with him for 10 years, just really how he exemplifies the Olympic spirit and truthfully is just the most humble and generous champion that I've ever met, I think. And Seth was actually kind enough to be on the Athlete Ally ESPN piece that we put together. The other Olympian that I have been extremely moved by was my teammate Alex Diebold, who got the bronze medal in Sochi. Or he might have gotten the silver medal. He'll probably not like that. I don't remember that. But no, he got the silver medal in Sochi. And we've known each other as peers for a very, very long time. And recently in the last year, through the Black Lives Matter movement and politically through the past couple years with Trump, he has really used his voice and his platform as a white cis male and somebody that so many people look up to on the surface, and just really dug deep to talk about issues of race, issues of sexuality. And for me, he's always been a real pillar to support me on issues of race and sexuality that I've experienced through my time on the team. So anyway, Alex Diebold, an Olympic snowboarder from Sochi, has just blown me away and will always be one of my biggest idols now.
Well, that's amazing. I'm so happy that we got to catch up, and I really appreciate you taking the time away. You can return to the boat and whatever you were busy with tending to.
Cool. Thank you, Sid. Thank you for inviting me. This has been fun. Really fun.
You can find Callan on Instagram, where I found her, at, and I just love her handle because it's so her, Callan the Great, C-A-L-L-A-N, the Great, all one word. It's always wonderful to catch up with these athletes and hear about, you know, why they came out, and also just, you know, talk about some of these folks who were in and around the Sochi Games, because those stand out so much as you know, such an important moment for LGBTQ athletes and the community. Thank you again for listening. Be sure to go follow Callan, and we'll be back next week with more from Five Rings to Rule Them All.